As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. And by ChargeBee. ChargeBee is the easiest way to set up your subscription billing. It's built on top of Stripe and integrates directly into your product.
Go to chargebee.com/rocketship to get started for free.
As you get more sure of the direction that you're skating, you can move into more of a, okay, let's make some serious investments and do things that the business needs, that we're hearing from our customers, that will keep us stable for a long time. And really just let problem solving drive that whole thing.
Today we talked with Benjamin Gilbert of Pioneer Square Labs, who was previously at Microsoft Garage. Pioneer Square Labs is essentially an idea incubation lab. And so they take various products and ideas and they build that MVP and they take it to market. So over and over, he is seeing that early product development cycle. So we talked to him about how they approach product development and the steps that they take to bring an MVP to market. Really insightful conversation here. So stick around. We're going to get right into it. Welcome to Rocketship.fm. Where we explore startups from funding to growth, from culture to sales, and everything in between. I'm Michael Saka.
And I'm Joelle Goldman.
So welcome. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear first a bit about your background and your current venture.
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs, a startup studio here in Seattle. And what we do is we come up with ideas for companies, and we're a team of designers, developers, serial entrepreneurs, and former venture capitalists. And we kind of develop these super early stage ideas into products and then see if they're companies that we could spin out. And then we look for really talented kind of tech executives to take these things forward. And then we're back to the drawing board and work on new problems.
Interesting. Very cool. And then before that, you were at Microsoft.
Yeah. I did a couple things at Microsoft. I spent some time running the Garage program, which is our sort of internal grassroots incubator. Basically, anybody that has a good idea that wants to work on something that is really outside the bounds of their day job, the Garage was the place for that. And before that, I was a product manager on Office for iPad. So got a good chance to work on sort of the early stage V1 before we shipped that.
Cool. So I'd like to hear about your product development strategy, since you guys are so focused on that now, on that early stage. I'd love to hear how you take a product from like ideation to the MVP.
Yeah. So for us, it's all about solving a customer pain. And there's kind of two stages of validation that we really focus on. One of which is verifying that people have this problem and they feel it super acutely. And the other one is about validating that our solution is actually one that meets their needs. So we really start with understanding a market and making sure, since the economics of our business are one where we start companies that get backed by venture capitalists, they have to be ideas in big spaces. So we do a lot of the much more kind of traditional business analysis of understanding total addressable market and how can we wedge our way in there and things like that. But what I focus more on is the early stage product development. So when we have a theory around an idea that we think, you know, hey, this space hasn't been disrupted in a while, or we think that there's a large and growing group of people that have a problem and we think we can solve it, we try and talk to as many people involved in that industry or that kind of that space that we can to verify that there's a problem. And then that second part is really around, you know, we spend maybe 2 months or so building product, and it totally varies based on whatever the company is. And then we kind of take the really rough, very embarrassing version of that product out and really get people to physically play with it. And I think that's almost a humiliating process, because you're getting all this feedback that whenever you come up with an idea, you're entirely wrong. You have like a nugget there that's right, but you like get to ever watch everyone touch all the wrong buttons and you know, you made something very confusing. And then our job from there is really taking that hopefully good insight that we had and like one good nugget, and then figuring out how do we make sure that the rest of it flows from there.
So what do you give them? I mean, what do you actually, is this a like a framer prototype or what are people using?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll use Spare 5 as an example. I was at Madrona Labs, but before this, this is my second startup studio, and we built this product called Spare 5, which enables people to make money in their free time by doing little tasks such as image tagging and things like that on the bus, and then you know, on their way to work or while they're sitting around. And on the other side of the business, there's businesses that want to, you know, have humans go through and do things that provide them large amounts of very useful data. So what we were doing, we were kind of solving two problems there. One was on this side of, can we make something fun enough that people would do it in their spare time and get paid for it? Mm. And then on the other side, you know, what's the type of businesses that actually need big data sets that are created by individuals that are good at a particular skill. Mm-hmm. So what we initially did to verify the problem was that's a time where we really aren't taking much around at all. We're often going with a list of notes and saying, hey, we think these are the top couple of pain points in your business, or we think that you know, you don't have a good solution for this, and trying to hear the same echoing comments from people over and over again that, yeah, you know, I struggle with XYZ. Now that we feel like, cool, box one is checked. And then when we go out to your point, do we take a framer prototype or something? You know, it really depends. For this one, we had a team of pretty talented iOS developers. So we actually just built like a very unstyled very unsexy version of the app that didn't have a backend, and it didn't have any of the sort of rich animations or things that it does now. And we took it out in just kind of a super raw form of actual executing code. It just happened to be, you know, all hard-coded and stuff on the device.
And what did you find? Like, what did you expect to find, and what was the actual result of that test?
Yeah, so there's a good one time we were on a team offsite, and we were like really it's strangely hard actually to go and talk to strangers, especially when you're trying to explain like, hi, I'm an early stage product person, and like, this is a weird question, but like, will you play with this very bad app?
And right.
It's like, it's very embarrassing. So we were talking to the lobby staff, and then just going down at weird hours where there weren't customers, and they were kind of just hanging out talking anyway, and having them use it. And the thing that we really learned was it's way less fun than we were hoping it would be. Mm-hmm. That we had kind of two goals, and one is, you know, people give high quality answers when we ask, describe this photo. And the other was that they have enough fun doing it that they'll continue to do it. And it took probably, you know, we actually spun it out to the full-time team and then stuck with them for probably, you know, 3 or 4 months afterwards. And it took a really long time, probably the first year, to actually make it fun. That we were relying really heavily on the fact that, you know, they were making money, and that they felt a little bit of satisfaction from doing this thing, but actually coming up with the experience that someone wants to do this because they're intrinsically feeling rewarded and proud of the work that they've done, that was a thing that we really missed on at first.
Interesting. Okay. And I mean, what made you keep going to think that you could make it fun?
Yeah. You know, I think initially we thought that the sort of business case for companies needing these rich data sets was enough that we could sort of overpay people for a little bit, or potentially, you know, rely on other things that rather than just fun. Like, we were going to maybe churn through people faster than we had hoped, but maybe we can go out and get more users to accomplish the same goals. I think that we weren't necessarily confident that we could make it fun. I think we were going to try and get as many of the right people that we could who had done game design or use any sort of game mechanics, or really built there's sort of two sides, right? The game mechanics and then the actual truly rewarding experience of the action. Okay. And kind of build teams around that. But yeah, initially it was more about, well, okay, maybe it's not fun enough, but we have other levers to pull.
So we're going to get right back to our interview with Benjamin after a word from our sponsors. When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. So, and kind of off the product of topic a little bit, but I'm curious about the data side. Was there any apprehension that paying for the data would reduce the accuracy of the data?
That hasn't been a major concern. I think our bigger concern was that we wouldn't be able to find the right people to give us the accurate data. And the way that we sort of got around that, one example that we always talk about is we had a company that needed 100,000 photos of homes tagged to say, this is a living room, this is a dining room, this is shabby chic, this is modern, this is contemporary. And it was for a big customer in sort of the home renovation space. And we had to rely initially on people connecting their Facebook and then using the Facebook data to understand what their professional life was, what their work history was, and then making educated guesses on do they qualify for this task. And we ended up moving into sort of a two-step model where I was just sort of personally combing through all these Excel spreadsheets of data that were generated. And before you can really like write any algorithms or use any litmus tests to determine if data is good or not, it's always a good idea to just sort of pour through it and immerse yourself in it and let the human brain do its magic of pattern matching. And what we were sort of figuring out was there's definitely people that are listing themselves as a professional interior designer or a decorator or a home builder or something that like weren't actually good at doing this particular task. And it was unclear if maybe they were like on a device where the screen resolution was, or, you know, the it was too small, or they didn't have good eyesight, or they were breezing through it. But ultimately what we ended up doing is building a second component where you have to pass a quiz first with a bunch of known answers and get, you know, a 80% or higher in order to qualify for this.
Hmm. Okay. So back to the product side of things.
Yeah.
what was the next step after you kind of tackled the usability, you know, how do we engage people with it? What was the next step in the product development for you?
Yeah. For us, then it became about the process of delivering that, since we had a two-sided marketplace, the process of delivering that data in any sort of sensible way to our real true customer, these businesses that needed large data sets. So originally it was, you know, it's early stage, so you're doing this sort of poor man thing of putting it all into a Google sheet and then sending that over and then writing an email with your personal recommendations and then realizing that's kind of a crappy customer experience. Like, that doesn't instill confidence that we're a business that they should, you know, integrate into their workflow and then trust. So then it became about, okay, how can we build dashboards that are more like what people are accustomed to? And that part was a lot about just researching products that I had really liked using in a B2B context. So products that I felt like, wow, this dashboard is really well made. Or, you know, this whatever login screen looks like the standard login screen that people are used to. And I always feel like product development has two sides to it. There's the side where you decide it's outside of your wheelhouse. It's not the core competency of your business and you should not reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. And you look for what are world-class examples of people that do that really great. So for, you know, branding and copywriting, I always look, okay, what would MailChimp do? Because the thing that my business does is not necessarily being the best at our messaging and cutesy graphics and all that. We're really good at another thing, and we just have to be like pretty good at that area. So right. let's figure out like what's best of breed of that, and then do something in that vein. And then where you can really innovate is, okay, what do we actually think is our differentiator as a business? And maybe we need to kind of use a new paradigm there and really go back to the drawing board and spend a bunch of cycles as designers and product people and developers and come up with something truly new.
Interesting. And how do you know, is it the continual cycle of going back to the people and testing even these ideas? Like when you're trying to innovate, how do you know when you've hit on something that will work?
Yeah,
do you ever know? I don't know.
it's rare and takes a long time. But I think the product development process, at least in the early stage with customer validation, is the process of getting less wrong. So, you know, you hope to be directionally correct when you go and you talk to someone and their feedback now is, oh, you really incorporated what I was saying, or, oh, I didn't even notice that I kept hitting the wrong button before. It looks like you moved it into the right place. And a lot of times you see things too, where people will like, once they get a phone in their hands or you put them in front of a website, they'll be like doing a gesture that they expect to work and doesn't work. Mm. And then if you're able to go back, implement that and bring it back, and you start seeing that they're just more natural at using the thing, and they can't really articulate why, but they'll tell you like, oh, this is much nicer than last time. And you really try and make every time that you go back and talk to people a little bit better. And you're going to have missteps. So then you try and say, okay, that was a bad idea. And just make your process easily reversible to go back and then figure out what is the direction to make it a little bit nicer every time.
And is there a methodology that you follow when building product, be it agile or lean or waterfall? Is there something that you kind of bring to the team that sets a structure for how this will work?
I think there's good things in each of those methodologies. And I think the like funny thing about agile is no one actually does it 100%. It's like you take the best things and then you fork it and make your own little methodology based on it. I would say that we really do these sort of 2-week sprints. I don't think that it's super formal. I think it's a team that is, it's a thing that's sort of understood by the team of, you know, we don't want to wait too long to release this thing, but we want to get it out there. And you end up, you know, with an app, a slower release cycle, but with a website, a faster release cycle. But I always think that the thing driving kind of how often you should release and how large your release sizes are is how much of this is an experiment versus how much of this is a need, like a do or die for the business. And I think that when something is an experiment, you don't necessarily overinvest in it. Like you try and get more signal. And in the early stage, everything is about trying to get a little bit more signal from your customers, a little bit more signal from the market. How can I get more information? And then you're doing these kind of faster releases more often because everything is an experiment. So you're trying to do whatever the minimal investment that you can to learn the thing that you want to learn. And then, you know, the flip side of that is as you get more sure that as you get more sure of the direction that you're skating, you can move into more of a, okay, let's make some serious investments and do things that the business needs, that we're hearing from our customers, that will keep us stable for a long time, and really just let problem solving drive that whole thing.
Mm. Who does this really well? Is there, like you mentioned MailChimp for copy, is there a team that does product really well that you look to for maybe inspiration or insight?
Mm. This is going to be a weird answer because I think that it was really, really terrible for a long time, but recently Snapchat, when I was talking earlier about, you know, doing things that are unique and new versus doing things that are taking a cue from everyone else, I remember being on Office for iPad, and there was a lot of things where there were already examples of really great productivity that were native to the iPad. And we would look to them and say, okay, what are the things we can take from this? And then what we're bringing to bear here, our core competency is, you know, it's the Microsoft Office that you know how to use and would expect and is totally compatible. And I remember hearing, I was talking to a friend at Snapchat, and he was saying how, you know, it's a culture of people that absolutely do not do that process. You're scoffed at, but in the culture there for, you know, looking at examples of, well, how did Facebook do that? Oh, they made a news feed. Let's do a news feed. Right. Because their whole thing is about making a unique and different entertainment experience, entertainment and communication, I would argue. And so, you know, you look at Snapchat and it's all gestural and there's a lot of sort of hidden things you can discover and totally crazy. And you know, classically, all of our parents now that are getting into Snapchat, it's like, I don't understand it. It's so confusing. It's because they really, you know, went to the mat and invented a new paradigm there for how you navigate and use in a mobile application.
Mm-hmm. And that almost becomes their advantage.
Right, right. And I look at it like, you know, no one has been able to duplicate the success that they've had because they're so laser focused on, we are not going to, in this one area that is our core competency, look to other people and make a thing that looks like the Facebook app that is just a different social network and happens to be ephemeral. They really said, this is the thing that we're going to innovate on.
Yeah. So what was one of the hardest things for you to learn about product in the last couple of years?
Yeah. So, there's these ups and downs of being in a studio environment. In the last 9 months, we've worked on 21 different ideas, and only three of them are living today. So the really hard part is evaluating and coming up with, some are soft and some are more rigid, but criteria for when you should stop working on something that's not working versus, no, we just have to push a little bit further. And it's something that I think I'm kind of personally still working on. I worked on a project for 5 months from January to May that we ended up winding down. And it's really hard to kill your baby, to be dispassionate about something that you've put so much time and energy into. And there's like a piece of ourselves that gets embedded in every product that we work on. And I always like with really good products, you can see like, oh man, like I know something about the people that worked on this. They like put themselves into it. But the drawback is that it makes it really hard to walk away from something. And so there's like a little, there's a little period of like a lack of creativity or a lack of wanting to start something new because you feel like a little bit wounded after you wind something down that you were really invested in.
And how do you know when to wind it down? That's like the ultimate question, I know. But, when do you guys decide to wind down?
Yeah. Starting at the kind of one side of the spectrum, you could work on something actually forever. There's always, if you talk to any CEO of a company that, did their seed round, raised $1 million, and then they ended up winding it down and you ask, why didn't it work? Blah, blah, blah. What would you do next? They always have what I would do next if I still had some more money.
Okay.
There's like another direction I could have explored or another feature that we could have done that, I feel like, I don't know if that would have worked, but maybe.
Yeah.
And, and here, this is sort of a microcosm for funding and continuing to fund or stopping to work on companies. So for us, it's about constraints of the model. We've decided that our success will come from spinning out 2 to 4 companies a year and with a team of 10 with, 1 to 3 people working on each one. It means that we work on ideas for 3 to 6 months. And if we don't believe that we can validate the idea within that amount of time, we shouldn't be working on it. And it's very easy to do at the beginning is look at something and be like, oh yeah, that'll take, that's an enterprise software thing that has a sales cycle of 1 year plus a product development lead time of 2 years because you need all these features. It's super easy to, before you get into it, decide that you shouldn't work on it because it won't fit in this sort of unique artificial time constraint that we've created for ourselves.
Okay.
But the really hard thing is once you get like a couple months in and then you start to slowly discover like, oh crap,
this is big, this is like...
It's going to take us a while to get to table stakes with what people are expecting here. And then like not falling into that sunk cost fallacy of, I already put two months in. Does that mean that I'm going to continue just because I've put 2 months in? So I think it's different for every business and it sort of depends on what constraints you've created for your team or if you're a small company with super limited funds, like the very real constraints of your business.
Right. And so do you guys have numbers or that you set beforehand that you're looking to hit, numbers or goals or something that determine like, hey, this is successful. We can continue to fund this. Or like you said, I mean, you're continuing with 3 of 40, something like that.
3 of 21.
3 of 21. Sorry. So are there constraints that you set beforehand that you say like we need X number of users or we need to get this type of reaction from people?
Yeah, totally. And like some of these are more soft and some are more rigid, but we kind of split all of our companies into two buckets. There's business to business and business to consumer.
Okay.
And in business to consumer, there's sort of three magical metrics that it turns out when you go and try and raise money around these early stage ideas, basically everyone seems to care about. And that is growth, retention, and engagement. And so there's pretty standard, you know, there's weekly active users, which is your growth number. And we shoot for, you know, 5 to 10% week over week on any consumer product that we're working on. And that seems to be, you know, if you're able to continue on that trajectory for 1-2 years, you're able to really build something that has momentum there. Mm-hmm. Engagement, you know, you want to be creating something that's super habit forming. So we've shut companies down that we determined people are coming back once every 2 weeks. That's like not habit forming enough, and you end up not being at the front of people's minds. You want people opening this as part of their daily routine. And if not, at least, you know, a few times a week as part of their maybe they open it only on the weekends, or maybe they open it only on the weekdays, or maybe it's a Monday morning thing. But either way, it has to be something that's part of the cycle of their life that gets integrated. Fair. And then retention, you know, that one's a little bit squishier, because you can have a business even if you're churning out users for a while, and then you try and clamp that down. But ideally, you know, people are not coming in and then immediately moving on to another thing to catch their attention.
Okay.
Yeah. And then on the business to business side, that one's much simpler. If you have a B2B product that likely has a much higher price tag, just having, you know, a few, like I think for Sparify, we had 3 paying customers by the time that we decided, yep, this thing has legs. We're going to spin it out. We're going to raise money and go and find people for it. We believed through a bunch of research that idea could be sufficiently large, that the market was big enough. And we were like, cool, we're actually not having a hard time getting people to pay us. That has legs.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. Where do we keep up with you? Where can we, you know, keep up with the many products that you're putting out?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking. And thanks for having me. I'm on Twitter at Gilbert, and if you follow me there, you'll probably end up getting very strange. We talk a lot about, we're kind of like closed about the products we're working on, but okay. Oftentimes we're asking questions on Twitter about people who've been in the space, so you'll get a good insight about what we're actually working on there.
Interesting.
On Twitter, and then I do a podcast too, so it's called Acquired at acquired.fm, and we talk about technology acquisitions.
Awesome. Awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Talk to you.
I really hope you're enjoying this product series so far. We still have a little ways to... Big thanks to our sponsors, Team Gantt. Go to teamgantt.com/rocketship and use the code SAVEONTG to get 50% off your first 6 months. And by Brand Bucket, go to brandbucket.com/rocketship. You get a special offer. Plus, you can get your next company name, logo, and domain all in one spot, just like Mattermark. You really can't lose there. And by ChargeBee. ChargeBee is the easiest way to set up your subscription billing. Go to chargebee.com/rocketship and get set up for free. So follow us on Twitter at RocketshipFM. You can follow me at Michael Saka, Joel at Joel Goldman, and we'll see you back here in just a couple days.
Want to reach the girls? Follow us on Twitter at RocketshipFM. And where's not that you are listening? Thank you. Bye-bye.